on the assigned subject today? Nobodies can become somebodies. And there are plenty of Bibles back there. And I'll ask someone to read when the time comes. The 14th and 15th verses of 9th chapter of Ecclesiastes. And then a little while later, I'll ask somebody to read the first 7 verses of Romans 16. The way I plan to do this morning is after some brief announcements here to have prayer, and then I'll discuss this subject, which is a study in contrast, and give you some of my experiences on this subject, and then we'll open it up for discussion. I'd like the views of you on the why of these verses in Ecclesiastes and other things that you'd like to discuss, and then I'll close it off in about the last 4 minutes, which will be 4 minutes to 10. I usually wear a button for the occasion, and as I thought about this subject, I wore my button that says PBPGINFWMY, which means please be patient, God is not finished with me yet. Will you join me in prayer? Now, Lord, it is hard for us to think that we can really be known and loved by you, the Creator God. It is hard for us to realize that you, who created the universe, also came and walked among us, gave sight to the blind, healing to the sick, and wept at the grave of a friend. And hears each child as it prays, now I lay me down to sleep. Continue to reassure us of your care, renew our trust, and let us hear through the confusion of our times, our names being called into service to you by service to one another, and through you help make nobodies become somebodies. Amen. In Hartford, Connecticut, some years ago, a circus tent caught on fire, and many lives were lost. All but one of the charred bodies were identified. One little girl lay unclaimed. She was buried in a local cemetery. Someone wrote this epitaph: there she lies as no one still, nameless on a lonely hill. And the snowflakes and the rain come and go and fall again on little Miss Nobody. It's stark tragedy, not to be claimed by anyone, to belong to no one, to have no one who cares, remembers, or to be ignored. It's a very terrible thing. This serves to introduce to all of you a Mr. Nobody in Scripture. For hidden from my sight for most of my years, until just a few years ago, are 2 obscure verses, which somebody is now going to read for me. It seems to occur suddenly, without introduction, in Ecclesiastes. Will someone read, please, verses 14 and 15 of chapter 9? And read real loudly.
There was a little city, and few men within it. And there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man.
We are left in the dark about this. There is no who, when, where, or why. It's all anonymous, impersonal, and indefinite. It stands in vivid contrast to much of the rest of the Bible, where every story is studded with names of people, even seemingly insignificant ones. The Bible seems to be obsessed with names. It seems to be a book in which no one is forgotten. You read it through and you find it's filled with names of kings, judges, prophets, army commanders, but it's not restricted to these. It seems that every story is filled with names of ordinary people, like you and me, whose name would never appear in any of the history books on our shelves. It seems this book has an obsession with names. Often there are more names than we really think we need, especially when you get into all the genealogies and all the begats. More than once I've asked myself who needs them. But when you stop and think about it, you realize these genealogies themselves are a witness to the Bible's concern for real people, where everyone matters. Most people, I believe, would expect that a collection of books dealing with the creation of the universe, the majesty of God, the rise and fall of empires, dealing as it does with matters ranging from time to eternity, and aware as it is of the littleness of man when the stars come out, would not bother with individual men and women, boys and girls. Why bother about inconsequentials when you're dealing with imponderables? In this regard, earlier this year, I visited at some length with Jim Irvin. Jim Irvin, as some of you may know, is one of those who spent 3 days on the moon. There aren't very many of those. And I talked to him a bit about insignificance. I like to, on dark nights, and here when you turn off the lights or just go out of the village on a clear night, it's really remarkable to look at the stars. And he told me about looking at the Earth for moon. It doesn't look all that big. In fact, it looks pretty small. But he said that it reinforced, really, his beliefs and how God cares for everyone. It seems that in the Bible, the ordinary people aren't inconsequential. Almost anywhere you turn, you find these ordinary people, strange people, some we'd ignore, but there no one is brushed aside. In the Bible, people matter more than philosophies of the universe, and I'm glad. Mary Schramm, I remember about 5 years ago, made, I think, a profound statement. She said, God takes away special people by making everybody special. As we read the Bible, we have to be constantly surprised by the human touch that keeps cropping up. It keeps appearing when the writer is expanding some learned doctrine of God or some fundamental of law. The Old Testament prophets, for example, aren't some faraway anonymous voices issuing their religious decrees from high up on some remote mountain, Buckskin or Glacier Peak or some remote heavenly perch. They were all very human, all different from one another, with their own peculiarities, whose adventures and peculiar twists kept surfacing. Let's face it, if we met one of them today, we'd probably more than likely label them as some kind of a nut, at least strange ducks. But let's all be thankful God makes use of strange ducks, or some of us would be unemployed. Regarding this human touch, It's interesting to read Romans, which comes pretty close to being a theological treatise. I read it all again recently, and it's pretty heady stuff, because for 15 chapters, Paul waxes eloquent on the problems of sin, salvation, justice, of suffering, of evil, of law and grace, and summarizes Christian ethics. And when you think he's building to a real theological climax, what does he do? Well, you're going to read it right now and find out. So if someone reads the first 7 verses of Romans 16. Don't be bashful, just speak with a loud voice. So you're recorded on.
I commend unto you Phoebe, our sister, which is a servant of the church, which is at Cenchrea, that ye receive her in the Lord as becometh saints, and that ye assist her in whatever business she hath need of you. For she hath been a succorer of many, and of myself also. Greet Priscilla and Aquila, in my helpers in Christ Jesus, who have for my life laid down their own necks, under whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. Likewise, greet the church that is in their house. Salute my well-beloved Epaphroditus. I didn't know there were all these words in here. I wouldn't have thought of them.
That's why I had somebody else read it.
Under Christ. Greet Mary, who bestowed much labor on us. Salute Adrodicus and Junia, my kinsmen, and my fellow prisoners, who are of note among the apostles, who also were in Christ before me.
You see, you made the point, because most of these aren't household words to you, are they? And then he goes on for about 20 more names. Only a couple more I'll mention. Greet Rufus, eminent in the Lord, also his mother and mine. And then another. Greet Nereus and his sister. I think he'd forgotten her name, but he remembered her. And my comment on that is that she was probably a very attractive young lady, and it sort of shook him up, so he didn't catch her name. And there's some credence lent to this, because a little later, in one translation, maybe he's feeling a little guilty, he said, greet everyone with a brotherly kiss. Now you can say that here he's gone on for 15 chapters, he gets to the 16th, and he goes off into all these names, which most of us can't even pronounce. And you say that's the climax to this book? Yes, in a way it really is. Because it's the people that matter. Each individual person. Our success here at Holden will in no small part be due to the recognition of the importance of each individual who comes here. And in your congregations, you are members of a bigger family, one in which love abounds, and heartfelt concern and sincere affection and respect is shown. But when you come to the outside world, its numbers, computers, and punch cards, as the malignancy of dehumanization metastasizes and spreads to the very marrow of our civilization, where legislation is even being considered to put the incapable to sleep. Now, ever since that I've been coming to Holden Village, which is now 15 years, and I've lost count, but it's over 40 times, there has been concern expressed, I guess, almost every year with the dehumanizing forces at work in our technological society. We've discussed Jacques Ellul and his writings on the subject. Even these past few weeks, Al Pitcher and Walt Bowman, before you came, and to an extent, I guess, Joe touched on it, and the Schrams have mentioned it. I'm certain that we, all of us, at some time or another, feel the pressure and the concern of being numbers classified in some inaccessible file. We have cause to wonder about the future control of human birth, the sex of a child, the human brain, and death itself. I could go into some length on this relative to the control of the human brain, But I won't. The province and position of people seems to be diminishing. Freedom is being limited. Those of you who go to the tape library, you hear perhaps Rudy Edmonds' discussion of Heilbronn's The Human Prospect, which is a pretty grim presentation. Walt Bowman referred to that last week, in which there's a recall that our very humanity is being threatened. We are becoming just small, insignificant cogs in a big machine, or mispunched cards in a giant computer. And that's why I wear this button. I am a human being. Do not fold, spindle, or mutilate. That's why they put buttons out like this. And I think, again, I referred to Jim Irvin earlier. And the thing that really made news on Apollo 14, and most of you can't remember it, probably much description of it at all, but I can recall one event which probably everybody remembered. You don't necessarily think of the great and tremendous power and all the technology that went into this, but the event from Apollo 14 that most people remember was when one of the astronauts took out a golf ball and hit it and it went sailing. That was kind of a revolt, really, against these dehumanizing forces. So I thought it was great. But how does God see us? He sees us as persons with infinite value and fantastic potential. Consistently, you and I are viewed as nothing less than children of God, rebelling children, wayward children, naughty children, handicapped, but sons and daughters of the King. Hear what the Old Testament says about people. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon, the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? And they had the answer in a mysterious revelation. Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the work of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. And they said all that, fully realizing the meanness, the pettiness, the apparent insignificance all around them. So you see, in this book, no one is dismissed as of little account. No one is expendable. No one is forgotten. And the big reason for this is what is told in the four Gospels. There is the secret about a man whose resurrection we celebrate here at Holden every day, in your churches every Sunday, for whom they made extraordinary claims. Each of the gospel writers believed that this Jesus was none other than God's personal revelation to people. He was the culmination to all that had gone before. He was, for them, the Son of God, the Word made flesh, the divine Savior of the world. And those are some pretty wild claims when you really think about it. So having made these claims, you'd expect learned treatises on theology, nature, philosophy, destiny. But what do you find? You find little stories of an itinerant preacher talking to people while traveling along dusty roads in a place really not much bigger than the county in which we are in right now. The story of the Son of God comes to us not as an encounter with great philosophers, Roman rulers, or even Eastern mystics, but with ordinary people whose names would never be known beyond a few miles of their birthplace, if that, and have been forgotten probably even before they died. It seems he went out of his way in this insignificant Roman outpost, talking to the most insignificant and neglected, to all the nobodies. He spoke to beggars, the crippled, the blind, the deaf, the lepers. He ate and even drank with people most of us would not even think about inviting to our house or our church. It didn't seem to make any difference whether he was speaking to a Roman soldier, a hated tax collector, a prostitute, a member of the Sanhedrin, a doctor of theology, a housewife, an army officer, or a businessman, or people who were demented. He simply addressed each one as a human being, a unique member of God's family here on planet Earth. Now we have to be impressed at this Jesus, who believed his father cared for each child, woman, man, bird, animal, and plant. What each of us must realize, what comes through loud and clear, is that God cares equally for each of us. This God, who is the Lord of heaven and earth, cares for everything, everything that he made. Now, Jesus shook up a lot of people when he declared that even a no-count sparrow couldn't fall without God knowing it. And I'm a bird watcher, and sparrows aren't really high up on the ladder. Some of the sparrows are interesting, but they're hard to classify, and most people don't spend a lot of time watching sparrows. And then he went on to say, "You are worth more than any number of sparrows." Worth more? To whom? God, of course. So you'd expect him then to stop with deep concern to talk to a blind beggar when everybody was telling the blind beggar to shut up and not disturb the master. And it was natural for him to single out one of the most unpopular people in town, a sawed-off tax collector named Zacchaeus, peering down at him from a tree one day. And it wasn't enough that Jesus greeted him. He invited himself to his house. "Zacchaeus, be quick and come down. I must come and stay with you today." He called him by name. And then there was a day that the children were swarming around. The disciples were trying to run him off, to keep the kids with the runny noses and the sticky fingers off his back. But he stopped his disciples. He wanted the children to climb over him, runny noses and all. And he went on to tell his disciples, "Of such is the kingdom of heaven." Heaven would really not be heaven without the likes of Isaac and Paul, little Paul, and the Jeffs, and the Lorries, and the Scots that are in Holden Village today. After hearing these accounts, you just have to have the feeling that there could absolutely be no one, no matter how young or old, how crippled or deformed, how retarded, how lonely or rejected, how insignificant or inconsequential, could possibly be forgotten by this father. And that is what this Jesus came to reveal. The real world where no one is forgotten. There everybody's name is known. There are no Miss or Mrs. Nobodies. There are no Mr. Nobodies. After Jesus came, it was possible for all the nobodies to become somebodies. Now, there are several questions that I'm going to address, such as, how does one enter this so-called real world that I've labeled? And who can enter it? Now, I'm going to tell you about some of these, but I'm going to take a diversion here. And then there's another question we'll discuss, is why isn't this poor old wise man named? And you're going to help me with that. But before I do that, I'm going to recall for you something Martin Luther said, and I'm glad he said it. He says to all of us today, as he did then, "Love thou God in his creatures." By these words, Brother Martin wanted not only to encourage us to serve people, but to impress upon us that it is our high calling so to do. Brother Martin did not go in for scholarly speculations on God's unfathomable mysteries, but what he believed and emphasized was that faith and love are the whole substance of a Christian. God's Son made himself of no reputation and took upon himself the form of a servant, empties himself of his glory in allowing us to show our love for him by loving our neighbor. Whatever kindliness, care and concern, thoughtfulness and daily help we give to our brother and our sister, he considers it done for him. But we find it very difficult to love God in such practical and concrete ways. It's much easier to write a check. There are people about us who are so deformed we would like to shut our eyes to them and completely avoid them. And I'll call to mind some of these for you now in the next few minutes. I recall I gave a I made some presentations at probably one of the largest churches in Seattle, or out at Bellevue. And I think there were three services that morning. At the main service, there was an immigrant who every Sunday would go with his truck and go down and pick up some spastics, some people with cerebral palsy. And he'd roll them into the front of the church in their wheelchairs. Now, a spastic is someone who has difficulty controlling his voluntary movements. They kind of wave around without control. Varies among them. They often talk and grimace, and it's very hard to watch them. Sometimes they utter noise. They do not, many of them articulate as we know articulation. And I noticed that it was very disturbing to some of the people that were there. And this was my impression too. When last fall, I was on business in Europe, and I took 2 days off to go to Hanover to catch the train for Bielefeld, Germany. I had heard that Bethel was the nearest thing to the kingdom of God on earth, and that's something I wanted to see. I'd also read Bright Valley of Love by Edna Hong, and I'd talked to people that were there, and also I was very interested in their use of pets in therapy, because it's an interest of mine. So I took 16 hours off and went down there. It was probably the most remarkable 16 hours of my life. To show you something of the philosophy of the place, Alex Funke was here. He's the present director, a truly remarkable person. If you want to hear more about it, you can go and listen to his tapes in the tape library. And here he is running a fantastic operation, but he still has time for the people there. And he took time off from his busy schedule to have supper with me and my host, Friedhelm Huki. And he told me during this supper two things that I think manifest the philosophy, in addition to that the door is always open there. Anybody that needs help can come in. The front door is never closed. But he said that, number one is the patients are the professors. And the other thing is that he understood his mission there. His mission there was to make sure that everybody who came understood that God loves them. And if he could do that, that was enough. Now, during my tour there, they took me to many of the places. A little history might be appropriate for you. It started in 1867. When some Christians in Westphalia decided that that back rooms and attics were not the appropriate place to keep the retarded and the epileptics. And so they bought a small place in Bielefeld, which they named Bethel, or Bethel, the city of God. And the philosophy was that they would live with the unfortunates that came there. And this philosophy has extended to the present time, when there are over 5,000 exceptional people there, and over 5,000 who take care of them. And they finally called a director, and that in itself was in a way a miracle. They called a fellow named Father Bodelschwing. Father Bodelschwing was a young pastor whose one of his first assignments was in Paris, ministering to the German workers there, because in that period of our history, many of the Germans were the poor laborers in a foreign country, which was Paris. They're like the southern Europeans in Germany today. So he was there ministering to them, and then he, as I recall, got called to a parish. In a period of 11 days, I think it was, he lost all four of his children, he and his wife. They died. And a pastor friend came to him, and he said, God will replace your children. And shortly thereafter, he was called to be the first permanent director of Beto. That was in 1871. And he had four more children. And when the fourth one was born, his name was Fritz. And the day he was born, this person who many years before had said, "God will replace your children," he hadn't seen him for a long time, showed up unannounced. Well, he had a remarkable ministry there because he was a genius in many ways. They took land that was not profitable and figured out what was wrong with it, and so they have a large farming enterprise and a lot of other things. In 1910 or 11, his son Fritz, who took over, and Fritz had a remarkable ministry there. This will become evident in a few minutes as I tell you about Rick Arden. Is Chief here?
Yes.
Say, will you go up and get my folder on Beto? It's sitting on my my black briefcase by my bed.
Okay.
Thank you.
While she's doing that, Leo, but we also recall that they had not only been concerned about the physically disabled, but when the Jews could find no place of refuge under Hitler, the door was open at Bielefeld. And again, after the war, when the Nazis oftentimes were not received anywhere, that is, those who were among the leaders, then the doors at Bielefeld were open to them.
Yeah.
A remarkable demonstration, I think, of what Christian love actually is.
Yeah.
I was there in 1960.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it's truly remarkable. The night that I was there, they took me around to many of the places, and the most remarkable one to me was Ebenezer House. They have them all named, but it's biblical names. They live in a household type thing. And they were eating. I asked to see, because I was interested in how they fed them, what the nutrition was and everything, and they had tables for various ones depending on what their nutrition should be. And a blind man greeted me warmly. In fact, all of them greeted me very warmly. I suppose the most warmest greetings I ever had in my life were from the residents, the so-called disadvantaged at Beto. They'd stop what they were working, come out and shake hands with me and tell me they were happy I was there. And some of them didn't make sense as we understand sense today, but they really warmly greeted me. They took me upstairs while they were eating, and my hosts, and looked at some of the places, and to show you the kind of concern they have, they stopped at one cubicle where there was a very simple person lived there, two of them were there, and he apparently was very fond of little cars, and it had a makeshift shelf. And tomorrow was going to be a day of celebration. They have a lot of celebrations there, but they were going to have a big party because it was his birthday, and they had built a very fine cupboard. Really, really well structured, had sliding doors. They proudly opened it up and showed me that there was a light in it. And this was the new cupboard for his little cars. We went downstairs. We started to go downstairs, and by this time, many of the people are out from eating. And many of them were in wheelchairs, some were just sitting around, and one was on a pad. And it was one of these situations where if you saw him from here over to there, you'd turn right now. He was making all kinds of funny faces, and his hands were waving. But they obviously wanted me to meet Rickard. So, he saw me coming, and he wondered where I was from. I was from the United States. Well, he got pretty excited about that. And then he found out I was a veterinarian. He got even more excited and began questioning me. And some of the questions were, do you ever take care of birds? Yes. Are you ever able to make them fly again if they break their limbs? How do you give therapy to fish? And questions like this. Well, this was kind of interesting. He was obviously a very bright person. His German was pretty hard to understand, and I don't understand German that well, although I spent a good deal of time there trying to learn it as a prisoner of war, but it was a pretty materialistic German, Haben Sie Brot, things like that. But I should stop at that point to say that he'd spent the first 50 years of his life flat on his back. And then some visitors from the United States, some volunteers, students, came over, as they do from all over the world there. And they were very interested in Rickard and others, and they worked and worked and worked and worked with him. And now he's able, with great effort, and he has a strap from here down to his leg, he can slightly sit up, so I suppose television is a little easier to listen to. And some of his questions were a result of having seen something on television that suggested these questions to him. His last question to me was, thank you, Chief. His last question to me was, do you employ any Indians in your college? And I says, well, yes. But I wondered whether they were Native Americans or Indians from India. But I didn't ask him that. And so we said goodbye. There was a lot of joking back and forth with his host. And he was a very obviously a guy with a great sense of humor and a great outlook. And then I asked my host as we walked away, these Indians he asked about, I says, are they Native Americans? Because I thought he'd seen something on television, or are they Indians from India? Oh, he says, no, they're Indians from India. He says, he is very interested in Indians from India. In fact, he supports a little child in India. And I says, how in the world does this guy support a little child in India? Oh, he says, what I didn't tell you is that he has control of his right foot. And he paints very beautiful pictures with this right foot. And we frame them and sell them. And all the money goes to support a little child in India. I'll show you pictures of this after we finish. I correspond with Rickard. And I just had a letter from him. And he thanked me. He wanted some pictures of our place. And so I sent him these. And I'll show you that letter too. And then I periodically send greetings to him. Now the story really doesn't end there, because what's important here is that Hitler put out the order that all of these people should be put to death because they weren't contributing to the success of the Third Reich. And Bodo Schwenk, of course, was greatly concerned about this. And he was a very smart fellow. And they put out orders that all of the patients in these hospitals would have forms filled out on, which he refused to fill out, because he was following this in other places where they had these hospitals. And he noticed that the obituary column was getting longer. They were putting him to sleep. And he even approached the high command. He wrote a letter to Goering. Had an unsatisfactory answer. I think he contacted some of the medicos, the people in medicine in the high command. And one day, Dr. Brandt, who was Hitler's personal physician, came with a bunch of people and make the final arrangements. And as the story goes, I think Fritz Bodelschwenk called Dr. Brandt off to the side because they had this Leben zum Wertes Leben, life not worth preserving. And in the conversation, he asked him what makes a person less than human, or what makes a person human. And he said it was his ability to communicate. And so Bodelschwenk took Dr. Brandt to House Patmos, where he had his worst cases. He says, I'd like to show you our worst cases. And I don't know all the ones that he contacted. He probably Henrietta, who was a retarded, epileptic, hydrocephalic. I don't know if you've seen them, their heads like this. Really blows your mind to see them. Asleep when he arrived, stroked the child on the head, called the child by name. Child turned over on seeing Bodelschwenk, big smile on her face. Probably saw Adolf, who probably knew three things. Food, which he loved and ate with great gusto, the colors, and Bodelschwenk. And so he went, and And then he turned to Dr. Brandt and he said, now, it's true that you may not be able to communicate with these people, but it's obvious that we can communicate with them. And with that, he walked out. Dr. Brandt behind him. And when Dr. Brandt returned to headquarters, where the rest of his associates were, he said, this was the end of the negotiations and they would be leaving. And it is important to point out that no one there was touched. Now, they didn't get any help from the Third Reich, but every day there was material piled at the front door. They probably did as well, if not better, than many of the people in Germany. Now, why were they saved? It is because somebody took time out for them, and as busy as Boleschwink was, he would go there often and play with these children. Play with Adolf, pull a red handkerchief over his face and pull it off, because he taught, these children taught him to really appreciate things that he didn't always fully appreciate, like colors and food. And this is a lesson for all of us. When Dr. Brandt, when the Nuremberg trials came up, Dr. Brandt, of course, was condemned to death for his complicity in sins of the Third Reich. And in the course of the trial, he did say that Dr. Boleschwink was perhaps the most remarkable person he had ever met. And probably some people say, and Carol Hinderle used to say, that that's probably where Hitler lost the war. Of course, you see, already the name of Boleschwink and Bethel was known throughout Germany. And they knew what was going on there. And it was probably, was not, among other things, politically expedient. This is my own version of it, to do that. And to give you a feel for this, when I was in Germany last October, it was pretty touch and go because the terrorists were very active, and we'd be stopped at an airport and under a machine gun and go through everything we had. And they had roadblocks up. And my host was a long ways away from Bethel one day driving down the Autobahn, and he was stopped by a roadblock. And he asked for the policeman asked for his driver's license, and he showed it to him, and he said, "Well, I have to see your trunk and go through all your material." And then just as he was getting out of his car, he says, "Wait," he says, "Are you from Boleschwink Clinic?" "Yes," he said. "Oh," he says, "you can go on." So it's an automatic pass. When a fellow needs a friend, Dr. Craig Andrew and Robert Edgerton of UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute have documented a unusual relationship between two severely retarded individuals. Their relationship is rather unique because they have intellects that are in the imbecile range. Their IQs are in the 30s. Persons at this level of retardation are commonly held to possess only the barest rudiments of qualities judged to be human, the authors point out. The pair are known as Lenny and Ricky. Lenny, age 28, is a spastic, severely crippled of limb and speech, and also an epileptic. Ricky, 33, with a gait and speech, also in part, is blind. They are patients at the Pacific State Hospital, Pomona. The two boys have been inseparable for more than 10 years. Ricky sees through Lenny's eyes, and Ricky, whose speech is less impaired, speaks to the other to others for Lenny. They carry on extensive conversations with each other, largely unintelligible to others. Lenny zealously guards Ricky's meal tray from thievery above table mates, though he himself is not above attempting to sneak food from other table mate trays. Ricky cradles Lenny's head in arms during severe epileptic seizures. Meticulous sharing is a testimony to their pervasive friendship. Lenny's parents provide him with small sums of money which finance the pair's regular trips to the canteen where they share purchases of candy. Lenny also receives gifts from his fellows which he divides with Ricky, who has no known living relatives. Ricky reciprocates as best he can. Once Lenny was away on a visit to his folks, there was a barbecue for the patients. Ricky collected extra portions of food served at a barbecue and gave them to Lenny when he returned. There's almost a complete absence of hostility, bickering, or even open quarreling between the two, although they may clash violently with other patients. They greet each other with huge smiles, talk and joke together with obvious delight. When they are together, their faces and hands become expressive. Even Ricky's blind eyes become sparkling and alive. Each makes decisions that are binding on the other, and so they go through life, the halt leading the blind, with Lenny frequently saying to no one in particular, "I like Ricky best." Or as one regularly asks the other toward the end of the day, Did you like this day? What is human? What is human? Well, I'm running out of time. How do we get into this real world? I was going to read you something from Malcolm Muggeridge, how he entered the real world. It was while I was in the Holy Land for purpose of making three BBC television programs on the New Testament that a curious, almost magical, certainty seized me about Jesus' birth, ministry, and crucifixion. Now, this fellow was an agnostic. I became aware that there really had been a man named Jesus who was also God. I was conscious of his presence. He had really spoken these sublime words. I heard them. He really had died on a cross and risen from the dead. Otherwise, how was it possible for me to meet him as I did in the desert, wrestling with the devil on the hillside, preaching of how the meek inherit the earth and the pure of heart see God, falling in steps along the road to Emmaus? As I tried to explain in my commentary, the words Jesus spoke are living words, as relevant today as when they were first spoken. The light he shone continues to shine as brightly as ever. Thus he is alive, as for instance Socrates, who also chose to lay down his life for truth's sake, isn't. The resurrection is historical. Jesus is alive in very truth. The cross is where history and life and legend and reality, time and eternity, intersect. There Jesus is nailed forever to show us how God could become a man and a man become God. You too can, like Malcolm Muggeridge, make the rediscovery of Jesus and find he is still a living presence and a power that makes nobody's into somebody's. Sons and daughters of the King. Who can enter? In evidence, I present to you that day at Calvary when darkness fell over the whole world, when one of the most despicable people of that time, a representative of the worst of humanity, was hanging on a cross alongside of Jesus. He spoke to Jesus, "Lord, remember me." The reply was all important. "I tell you this, today you shall be with me in paradise." This means that to every nobody in the world has but to say, in contrition, "Remember me." This same Jesus will say, "Today you shall be with me," and not only today, but forever. You'll never be a nobody again. Now, with all these names and with all this concern, Why did we have these words in Ecclesiastes? This fellow that was, nobody knew his name, did they? Anybody want to suggest something for that? It is probably of significance that there are no names mentioned there, are there, in Ecclesiastes? There are no names, not even Jehovah or Yahweh is not mentioned. It isn't referred to in the New Testament either.
Evidently, names aren't important.
Well, they weren't in Ecclesiastes, but everywhere else they are.
the context in which it says that no one remembered him is significant, even though Ecclesiastes does not use name. It would almost seem as though that the wisdom that he brought to the need of the city did not square with the wisdom of the wise. He was effective, but despite that his being effective, they wanted to ignore him, for he was a witness to that their wisdom was not penultimate.
Anybody else have something to say about that?
I think maybe the context throws a little light on it. He wants to illustrate a fundamental principle, and if you go on to the 16th verse, he uses this as an example of a universal truth. This is Kokhma, or wisdom literature. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom, it doesn't really make any difference what his name is.
Yeah.
Anybody's wisdom is better, is despised, and his words are not heard. So I take it that in this context, it might even disturb the argument if the man's name were mentioned, that you'd maybe be guilty of a little hero worship or something, and that isn't what he wants to do.
Yeah.
Earlier in the Ecclesiastes 2, in chapter 6 and also 7, the 10th verse of chapter 6, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, so on. And then in chapter 7, a good name is better than precious ointment. Seems to be a distinction, or at least a somewhat of a distinction, between the actual name, like John or Bill or Paul or whatever, and what he stands for in terms of characteristics. And it's conceivably possible that you might not know if his name is Bill or, you know, Susan or whatever, but what he stands for goes beyond that actual physical naming.
And I think what's important is that he cared for others. Mm-hmm. Remove the mask from the one in need and you find God in. And what is important activity? And I'll tell you, and because there's quite a few people here from Gethsemane down in Portland, I was at Portland, gave a talk there one time. I think it was some circuit convention, maybe for LCA. And my first talk was on rejection. And in the course of this, I talked about rejection, and I told about our younger daughter, Becky. Becky had difficulty. Learning came very hard for her in academics effort, but by great persistence, she hung in there, worked harder than anybody else in our family, certainly. And she was very interested in retarded children and finished in special education and worked her first 4 years in Brainerd, Minnesota with a severely mentally retarded. And I told these people about one day when I flew from Chapel Hill to back home here. I guess I was in California then, or maybe it was in Pullman, 5 years ago. So, and I told them if you really want to go, have to go to Brainerd to get there. It isn't easy to get there. And I flew in there on a Saturday night, and Becky met me at the airport and landed there in a Ford Trimotor, and or something like it. And before we went out to eat, she took me down to her charges, and it was Saturday night. And as we walked in there, they were just putting her charges to sleep, to bed. Of course, most of them are bedridden. And when she walked in, it was like I watched the children, and it was as if Santa Claus had come. And she went from one patient to another and tickled some, talked to them all, called them by name, although some of them probably didn't recognize their name, but they knew her. And she told me the history of each one. It was obvious that that they loved her very much. And for some of them, she and her associates were probably the only ones that did love them. Some of their parents of these children never came. And I told these people this story. And after I'd finished, a person who was attending this convention came up to me, and he said, "I thank you very much for this." He says, "I have a son who was a great scholar. He was a great athlete. There wasn't anything this fellow couldn't do." And he says, you know what he's doing?" I didn't know what he was doing. He says, he's down here in Salem. He's down there changing diapers on people that don't know their children and people that don't know their right hand from their left. He says, "And every time I've been seeing him, I say, why don't you get into doing something important? Something," he says, you could be successful in anything. Why don't you do it?" And he says, I'm never going to say that to him again. Because who's to say what is important? Where our Becky was and where his son is, they are standing between maybe the only ones who stand between these people being nobodies and somebodies. And that's a very important place to stand. And who's to say what's important?
Mm-hmm. I heard a story almost parallel to that, and I can't even recall where I heard it from, but it was a lady that worked with me underprivileged, and one lady remarked, she says, "I wouldn't do what you're doing for all the money in the world." And the lady said, "Neither would I. Neither would I."
Yeah. That's right. Now, we all can't, one of the books I was going to recommend, because I read from you Malcolm Muggeridge, and he is most impressed, I suppose Mother Teresa has impressed him more than anybody else, and probably followed by Solzhenitsyn. And he wrote this book, and I was going to read out of it, but we don't have time, but this is a truly remarkable book. And where she went to India. She shed her habit after teaching and being a nun for a long time, teaching in a school for 20 years, about 30 years ago, lacking a few days, she got permission from Rome to shed her habit, go into a white sari with blue piping and a cross on her shoulder, and started a mission of mercy in the slums of Calcutta, which is extended now to many parts of the world. Now, you can't all go to India, but you can do what happened here. This is from Artis Burrington in Spokane. On the last day of vacation Bible school, a fifth grade teacher asked the children in a room to write, unsigned, what had been meaningful to them in school, not necessarily what she might want to hear, but something that had impressed them. A little girl wrote, And in the time allotted for it, the class prodded her to finish because she was pretty busy. She was slower than the rest of the class. She was pathetic both in spirit and in appearance, this little girl. All day she asked her teacher if she'd read the note. Finally, they read it together. It said, "Before I came to Bible school, I was nobody. Now I know I'm somebody. Thank you, Mrs. Carlson, for showing me I am somebody." And then this final story on Mother Teresa, which is required reading for you. She was given an honorary degree this year, I guess, in some college in Ohio. And she didn't give the talk, the usual talk under these circumstances. Given a doctor's degree, which probably was not a possibility for her, you'd think that, you know, this is a pretty big occasion. But her words, and I have it only secondhand, I'm trying to get the text of it, but she says, I just before I left India, I went in to see this lady that was dying. And I touched her, and she smiled at me. and I have to hurry and get back to her. Well, what's important? That's what the question before us. And I hope you have an answer.
In the Portland Church, Peace Lutheran Church, they had a chin-up dinner once a year. They've had it for years and years. And they bring all the handicapped, I guess, that belong to this group. They bring on beds and wheelchairs and blind. They have this dinner, and these people look forward to it the whole year. And it's just real touching. And my mother and I was gone, and one time we sat down, and there was a man next to me, and I didn't know who he was. And finally I realized he was blind, and I said if I could help him, and I helped him with his food, you know.
Into the nursing home, too, where some of these pitiful little people are.
Nobody really comes and visits them.
And way out last Sunday before I came, she was in the hall, and I'd never talked to her before. And she said, oh, what a pretty dress you had on. And of course, I didn't pay attention to that, you know, and we talked on for a while. And she said, oh, won't you come in my room and talk to me for a while? And I said, yes. And before I left, she said to me, she said, you know, this is worth more than money for me, just to have you come in and talk to me.
Now, there's a lot of people in these homes, and nobody comes to see him.
In regard to that, there is a chaplain in Portland who is asking for volunteers and has a ministry just to nursing homes. Mm-hmm. He's on the radio every KPDQ every afternoon about 4 o'clock, I believe.
I never met this old lady before, so I saw her in the hall. So I promised her I'd come back and visit her then, too, every time I came, though.
I'm going to discuss one of my interests, of course, in Beethoven is pet facilitated therapy, which is kind of a hot subject now, and people think, well, it's kind of a recent innovation.
What kind of therapy, Bill?
Pet facilitated therapy, using pets in therapy. Mm-hmm. And in Beethoven, they've had dogs and cats there probably. I asked them how long you've had these with the patients, and why, they said they thought probably since it started. And they have a lot of birds, water birds. And they also take in people of the way, which you and I call bums. Anybody can come there, they can work, almost everybody works, but they have to work if they can, and they're given nice lodging and food. Some of them stay forever. They have a retirement home for bums, for people of the way, and they have a lovely aviary right outside this place. They also have a wild animal park where deer are in a big area. So these are very important to them. Most recently, they brought in horses, Welsh ponies, because they're very therapeutic for epileptics and other people with balance problems. And somebody's given them a place to keep these horses, and so I visited them. And I recall, you mentioned these homes, convalescent homes and all. A remarkable thing happened there. I'm giving you, some of you won't be here on Saturday night when I talk about pet facilitated therapy, so I'll tell you about just one incident. There's a fellow who came there when he was in his late 50s, and he had fallen, so he was sort of incommunicado. He didn't talk to anybody. And by this time, it's now getting on to, he's about 80 years old, and one day somebody brought in a dog to him. The first time that people had heard him say anything, and they could just barely make it out, "You brought me a dog." Mm-hmm. And the next thing he said was, "Can I keep him?" Mm-hmm. And he began drawing pictures, tracing pictures of dogs, and then he began doing freehand drawings of them, which are quite remarkable. And now he's communicating with people. Now this is a fellow that was out of it for over 20 years, I guess.
I think it's too bad he's on medicine. Those have cats take them. I know I have a little dog, and I've talked to some of the people about, oh, I wish I could see your little dog, you know. But I know I don't dare take
them. I know. They have rules on it in many places. I'm trying to do something about that. I know the chief, when we used to visit her mother, who was in a convalescent home in Pullman, we moved over there. and we'd take, she'd carry Charlie, Charlie's her dog, and the patients would run to grab Charlie. They like warm fuzzies, huh?
We do have an exhibit that they take not only the tools, but also the convalescent dogs.
I'm trying to encourage her. See, a lot of these people, at that stage in life, they many of them have been pets for all their life. They haul them off to the retirement home, sterile and retirement homes, where they've taken away about the only thing that gives them unconditional love, and let them die.
This place in Germany, Little Bielefeld, is self-sustaining. They make their own clothes, they grow their own food, make their own shoes, and everybody works for them.
Everybody works. About 80% of them work, and maybe it's just a simple thing of taking the stamps that you've probably seen outside of our post office. There's a place where you put stamps for Beethoven. They collect them from all over the world. And some of those patients, all they can do is put these stamps in some water. That's their task, and they separate out the stamps. Last year, or a year before, they sold 200,000 marks worth of stamps. 200,000.
And they support the Mission Society.
All the money went. All the money went to Tanzania.
And they used to die too. My folks were there in 1936, and the sisters have been sending the stamps there since.
I just one of the friends of Holden is Roger Larson, who is just over there now, and I I'll show you some of these pictures of. Of course, Rickard's got kind of a fancy car, too. They take him around, and I'll show you that. Here's some of these pictures, the little ones. And they're really colorful. Some of them are pretty big, and I got a picture of him painting. Here's how he paints, laying down there. And Roger Larson, I just had a letter back from him, because I told him one of the places you got to go is Beethoven. Well, he had already decided that, because he was up here when Alex Funky was here. He says, "Dear Leo, you are wrong. Beethoven isn't great, it's unbelievable." And here's a painting done by Rickard, and he sent Rickard's greetings to me.
Are there any books on Beethoven?
Yeah, the...
It's
light. Yeah, there's his writings here. They have a book out. I don't think I brought it on Beethoven. They put out a monthly little publication that I made. Yeah, Beethoven Messenger. Comes out every month. I'll put that here. Bright Valley of Love by Edna Hahn. And we love Edna Hahn very much for many reasons. Among them, some of her royalties come to hold it. And here's...
The store has some things from Dato for sale.
Well, have they, Chief?
Yes.
Okay. So you heard the Chief. I was going to show you a letter. Somewhere I got a letter from him. Because, you know, he dictated, somebody else wrote a letter from him. Rickard's last line of his letter to me: "Do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? He is the only way to God. With thanks and best wishes." So that's all for today.